Good morning. My name is Jeffrey W. Ludwig. My attorney registration number is 10976, and I represent the appellants. This case presents the issue whether an attorney can circumvent Rule 1.5 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, forbidding attorneys from charging unreasonable fees by drafting a provision in the fee contract. The Bernards paid $204,000 to the Williams firm, and then the Williams firm quit. Mr. Poser, who had been working the case for the Williams firm, had demanded a contingent fee of 23%, or he would quit. The negotiations took place regarding the contingent fee agreement at a time when Mr. Poser had his greatest leverage, greatest negotiating leverage, and his clients had the most uncertainty. The matter was resolved by way of a settlement, which provided for two installments, the first installment to begin in December of 2008. The Bernards terminated Mr. Posner, and the Bernards filed two motions for the court to determine the reasonable fees for both Williams and Mr. Posner. The trial court had a pre-hearing ruling that the contingent agreement substantially complied with Chapter 23.3. The Bernards had the undue influence defense asserted by the Bernards had been eliminated due to ratification, and that the ratification was not the product of undue influence. At the hearing regarding the reasonableness of the attorney's fees, evidence was presented regarding double billing, attorney time for a proper travel and clerical work. Thousands of dollars were paid for litigation over production of the plaintiff's financial records and tax returns in a lost profits case. Thousands of dollars were spent concerning the enforceability of a indemnity provision in one of the business leases. Mr. Posner had elected to pursue and maintain unintentional tort claims in the underlying case, and the court in the case had determined that the indemnity clause was enforceable and applied to claims against taxmen except for those that were the result of willful, wanton, or reckless conduct. The negligence claim was dismissed at trial with Mr. Posner's consent, following the court's advisement that with the dismissal of the negligence claim, the indemnity problem would go away. In the court's ruling and judgment in this case regarding the reasonableness of Mr. Williams' firm's fees, the court listed the factors found at Rule 1.5, but did not engage in any analysis or application of those enumerated factors. There was no analysis whatsoever of what was a reasonable amount of time spent performing the services by the Williams firm. And indeed, the court said, for over a year during MCW's representation, the Bernards did not question the monthly invoices sent by MCW. Quote, the court will not now revisit those fees. With respect to Williams, the court then goes on to consider the hourly rate for Mr. Posner, block billing, and the one-quarter hour minimum billing increments. Now, the Williams firm claims that the court did perform a reasonableness analysis, but again, there was no reference of what reasonable amount of time for the services rendered. Since the court didn't spell out its reasons, since the court didn't spell out its reasons, there's no way for the appellate court to determine how the court arrived at its decision. Where significant rights are at issue, the decision maker must state the reasons for his determination. Also, the public policy of the state requires that a lawyer shall not make an agreement for a charge or collect an unreasonable fee. A lawyer may not insert a provision in the fee agreement as a way to circumvent that obligation. The fee agreements in the court ruling in this case put the responsibility for catching the attorney charging an unreasonable fee on the client. The trial court was offered numerous examples of improper billing. Two of them, August 14th, 2008, two lawyers met. Their time for the meeting and what they did afterward don't match. And there's a three-hour discrepancy, and that three-hour discrepancy for Mr. Posner was for downloading orders. Another, on June 11, 2008, 9.5 hours for responding to emails, calling the client, transmitting deposition notices, and preparation of a supplemental disclosure.
Our basis for review, actual findings, clearly erroneous. We can, most of the things that you're arguing about appear to be issues.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but the problem is that the court did not rule on these specific obvious examples of improper billing. The June 11th entry is for 9.5 hours to respond to emails, to respond to emails, a call to the client, and draft this disclosure certificate. The disclosure certificate only lists three documents and has less than a one-quarter page amendment to a previous damages summary.
So in the scheme of things, we've got over $300,000 in total. Your contention, the trial court had to address each and every discrepancy, and we can't imply that the court
Well, I think the court, if the court is going to make a reasonableness calculation, it has to address obvious examples of where unreasonable time was spent, or time was spent that didn't require the skill or knowledge of an attorney. Again, it was brought to the court's attention, thousands of hours were addressed to the issue about the production of financial records and tax returns in a lost profits case.
Mr. Ludwig, is it your position that the court did not do any reasonable determination?
Yes, and because that is the only conclusion that can be drawn based on the court's language, that the court will not revisit those fees.
Well, let me ask you, what do we do then when the court said it reviewed all of the files and then it made findings regarding the reasonableness of the fees, and it said that it had reviewed the voluminous files? So what do we do with that finding?
Well, I think the finding is inconsistent with what the order says. And I don't believe the court made a finding with respect to the fees collected by the Williams firm.
Counsel, in its order, it awarded, I think, $24,780, right, for the Williams fee?
Yes.
And then it said those were the fees that it awarded after subtracting the unreasonable fees from the Williams claim fees. So a negative implication, aren't they making a reasonableness? Isn't the court making a reasonableness determination by saying it deducted the unreasonable charges?
Well, I think the court just simply found something that was incredibly obvious, that this those were extreme fact, where clearly they were just mathematically rounding up these entries 245 times. But the order is
the court actually made 245 adjustments, right?
It simply found that there were 245 entries. That's correct.
I mean, that required some effort to do, correct?
Well, some effort, but there was also some testimony as to the number that was of these rounding up charges.
So when you say he made no reasonableness determination, I'm a little puzzled. I think we're all puzzled by that.
Well, because there's no analysis of the lodestar. There's no determination of what reasonable hours were expended on this case. None of the specific issues that were raised regarding unreasonableness were addressed by the trial court. The court also ruled that the contingent fee agreement has substantially complied with Chapter 23.3. Here in this case, there's some problems. In the brief, Mr. Posey asserts that the fee was due when, upon entry of judgment or a jury verdict or a settlement. The first installment payment was paid and he took 100% of his fee out of that. Then he also indicates in the brief that the fee wasn't due until he collected money. So there's an ambiguity in the fee agreement which goes to the essential term of when the client's obligation to pay is triggered in the fee agreement.
There was no claim, though, asserted by his firm for the balance of the fee, was there, until the second installment came in?
Well, there was no claim because all of the 100% of the claimed fee was paid to the registry of the court in the first installment from Mr. Taxman. Now,
Has Mr. Posner received the funds?
No, all of those funds are still in the registry of the court. Now, Mr. Posner was terminated before recovery in this case.
Is there anything in the record that indicates why he was terminated?
There's a reference in the brief that he was terminated for...
No, in the record, excuse me. Not the brief. I mean, is there anything in the record that indicates why he was terminated?
As a direct statement, no. But by inference, we have maintained throughout the case that because of the unreasonable charge by the Williams firm, because it was so great, that it created the very circumstance that made it so that the Benares were unable to continue to comply with the hourly agreement.
But there's no testimony to that effect. That that's the reason for the termination.
There may not be any direct testimony of it, but clearly that's the reasonable inference that's drawn.
Okay.
Since he was terminated before any recovery, there's no alternative compensation clause in the contingent fee agreement.
So is it your position that the attorney can be terminated after a successful result but before collection without any reason whatsoever?
An attorney who does not complete the triggering event, recovery, is not entitled to an attorney's a contingent fee. He only gets compensation if he's terminated before recovery, is if there's a provision in the fee agreement that allows for alternative compensation based on either quantum merit, if there's some notice given of the possibility of quantum merit.
So when the judgment, if the judgment is shortly after the award is received, but the attorney is terminated before the payment is received, he or she is entitled to nothing?
I think under the strict reading of Elliott and Vetting, that's correct.
Does that make any sense?
Well, I think it does, because the lawyer always has the ability to put in the agreement that if he's terminated before recovery, he can provide for alternative compensation. And indeed, the facts of this case are really more closely to Elliott than to the Mullins case, because only part of the settlement was obtained shortly after the settlement was reached. The remainder of the settlement was not recovered for some time and had to have another lawsuit to complete it. I think I'm going to reserve the balance of my time.
Counsel for Appellees, have you agreed how to split your time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Evan Cedar for the Williams Law Firm. And we've agreed to split our time equally. Is it possible to start so that I have 7.5 minutes showing here? I'll just keep track of my own time as we go.
We'll try and keep track.
I'll do my best.
I'm just the question.
Thank you.
May it please the court, the issue on appeal here concerning the issues of the Williams Law Firm are: to what extent does an appellate court review the evidentiary findings of the trial court? The legal standard of patently erroneous and unsupported by the evidence in this case clearly prohibits the Benares from setting aside the well-reasoned order by the trial court. To review quickly what the trial court did in this case, the trial court gave 2 full days of evidentiary hearing and then allowed the Benares to submit 3-ring binders of evidence with every single billing entry for this very complex case, with notations of counsel as to what was wrong with them in the opinion of the Benares counsel. The trial court went on to conclude that the Benares had never...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Was the annotations made by the expert or by counsel for the...
Counsel,
thank you.
Yes. The trial court reviewed all of that evidence, sifted through it. We obviously, in the body of his order, said that I have reviewed everything here and actually did make a reasonableness determination. One of the ways we know that is that the court starts out with an acknowledgement of, I'm here to determine the reasonableness of these liens. The court went on to talk about all the evidence, concluded that the Benares had not challenged the contracts themselves, found the contracts to be reasonable themselves, and then went on to rule on and enter judgment for amounts for both the Williams Law Firm and Mr. Posner's firm under the subsequent contingent fee agreement. The court has appropriately pointed out that there was a determination against the Williams firm when there was a claim that some of the fees were unreasonable. And I think the flip side is obvious, that the court did, by entering judgment, conclude all of the other fees that were assessed by the Williams firm were reasonable.
What do you make of the court's statement in its ruling that it was not going to revisit fees?
I went over that several times because I was troubled by that when I first saw it. And as I stepped back and looked at both the full paragraph and the entire opinion, I thought that was a determination that he didn't believe that the Ben-Aris were credible. And part of that is the timing of their all of their actions, starting with soon after a seven-figure judgment was entered and a settlement was negotiated by Mr. Posner. Now, for the first time, they're complaining about the fees of Mr. Posner, and there had never been any complaints about the Williams firm's fees there. I think the court was troubled by their motives and their credibility, and that's how I took it when I read that in the context of the entire order. Okay. Finally, I think it's important to note that the court did write down, the trial court said, I find that quarter hour billing increments are reasonable. The evidence below was reasonable, particularly from the experts on both sides of the issue. And after hearing everyone talk about that, then ruled, well, some of these things are unreasonable because we rounded up. And I think the issue before this court is whether or not, as a matter of law, can a law firm charge on quarter hour increments. I think that if you review the record and Mr. Posner's testimony in particular, it's clear that he wasn't charging 30 minutes for 16 minutes of work. What he did was try to do what every private practitioner does, is try to enter some amount that makes sense, that recognizes the amount of time that he actually spent on it. He did capture all of the time he spent for all of the different things on a case. And in accordance with the agreement, which was never challenged by the Ben-Aris, they entered into an agreement which then was billed to them exactly as they agreed to do. I think there's no evidence in the record, and I think that the findings of the trial court are troubling in this regard because there's no support for it. The judge says, everybody says this is okay to bill in quarter hour increments, but now I'm finding it's deceptive for the Williams firm to bill in quarter hour increments, to actually do that. And particularly when, one of the things I find, I've been doing this for 32 years, and I see that lawyers try to not take advantage of their clients. If they are outrageously taking advantage of their clients, then they can and should be reprimanded for that, either under RPC 1.5 or by having the court disallow some of their fees. I didn't get a feel for that here. I didn't get a feel that that's what was happening in the trial court. I didn't feel that that was part of the relationship between the Ben-Aris and Mr. Posner and actually the whole Williams law firm, which lended the material support to them. Those are my comments.
Counsel, am I right in the way the court did it was that you could not, the Williams firm was not allowed to charge at all until they reached at least 15 minutes because there was no rounding up permitted? So if Mr. Posner recorded one-tenth of an hour, which I guess was what he was doing, it would be improper to charge for that. Was that the trial court's holding, in a practical matter?
I think that's what the court was holding, is that the charge, even though the contract said quarter hours, there had been no complaints about it. If, and where he got into trouble was Mr. Posner billed 0.1 hour or 0.2 hours to Gibson Arnold, which provides the services of specialized kinds of people to law firms like Mr. Williams's firm. And the Ben-Aris say, oh, look, we got this through discovery. Now that means that this is somehow deceptive and unreasonable. And they never complained about quarter hour billing before because that's what they'd agreed to do. Was that a response to your question?
Right. The agreement didn't say every quarter hour or fraction thereof. It's just quarter hour increments.
That's what the agreement says, yes.
Okay.
Right, thank you.
Good morning. Greg Sapikoff, registration number 16184, and I'm representing Stephen Posner and the Posner Law Firm. Mr. Posner's case is really about the reasonable fee to which he's entitled under his attorney's lien, and that's an issue of fact for the trial court, and the trial court made findings in his favor that were well supported by the evidence, and that finding should not be disturbed on this appeal. But underlying that, really, the issue that's brought up is whether the Benaris and whether the law in Colorado would allow the Benaris to receive the full benefit of Mr. Posner's services after the time that the Williams firm withdrew from representation and pay nothing for those services. What he did during that period of time was he completed all of the discovery, he did the final trial preparation, he handled a 3.5-day jury trial, he obtained for them a substantially favorable verdict, and then locked in most of that judgment amount through a full and final settlement. And what the trial court found is that the Benaris terminated Mr. Posner's representation only after he had substantially performed all the services that he had contracted to perform, and that he did so, or that they did so, for the express purpose of trying to defeat Mr. Posner's entitlement to a fee they knew he had earned. Now, the Benaris have tried to make this case about whether the written contingency fee agreement itself is enforceable. And their arguments in that regard are, first of all, they contend that under Chapter 23.3 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, he didn't comply technically and strictly with all those requirements. And second, that the fee agreement itself was procured by undue influence. With respect to the Chapter 23.3 issue, their argument on this appeal is that it doesn't comply because it doesn't have an alternative compensation clause. But that's just clearly and demonstrably false. Because if you look at the contingency fee agreement itself, which is Exhibit 13 in the trial court and is part of the appellate record, there is a disclosure statement that's included with that fee agreement. And that disclosure statement, which is independently signed by the Benaris and by Mr. Posner, has a provision that's entitled Alternative Attorney Compensation. And that says, I have been informed and understand that if after entering into a fee agreement with my attorney, I terminate the employment of my attorney or my attorney justifiably withdraws, I may nevertheless be obligated to pay my attorney for the work done by my attorney on my behalf. So, and then in the fee agreement itself, it has a provision that defines that the fee is earned upon obtaining a judgment or settlement for the client, but then doesn't allow Mr. Posner to bill for that until the amounts are collected. There's not a requirement in there that he have a further physical involvement in collecting that money. And in this particular case, it's clear that the Benaris were put on notice that they would be expected to pay, even if they terminated the services, if Mr. Posner had obtained for them this kind of an entitlement to recovery.
Counsel, can I ask a question about the reasonableness?
Yes.
The court found that the 23% contingent fee was substantially below what was customarily charged for similar services in Denver. And I'm wondering about the basis for that. Was there any other, was there evidence that said that was reasonable in the context of where approximately $200,000 had already been paid and this was just 60 days before trial? I'm not diminishing the accomplishment of counsel at all, but this is a pretty unusual situation. And 23% may be below what's substantially charged at the outset, but is there any evidence that is a customarily charged amount in a similar situation?
Well, the evidence at the hearing was that from Mr. Posner was that was specifically negotiated because of the fact that substantial
fees
had been paid. And then there was testimony from Michael Berger, an expert that testified that when you consider the fact that substantial work had been done and he was taking it over in midstream as opposed to taking it from the beginning, his testimony was that was a reasonable fee under those circumstances, and that if he had been taking it from the very beginning, a typical fee would have been substantially larger than that.
I ask you to
address the undue influence issue. It appears that the court has said there aren't any issues of fact remaining for determination on that issue. And given that we've got some evidence in the record, at least an allegation of undue influence and concern, what do we do with it?
Well, first of all, what the court ultimately did is to determine that even if there was some argument of undue influence with respect to the fee agreement originally, that the Bernards ratified that agreement. And that clearly is a finding that the court, based upon the undisputed facts, could make as a matter of law. Because here, they were represented by counsel, independent counsel, at the time they entered into the agreement, Mr. Ludwig. But more importantly, after they entered into that agreement, having been advised by their counsel that the courts would highly scrutinize the agreement later on, they accepted all the benefits of the services. They let Mr. Posner go through the full trial, negotiate the settlement for them. They accepted all the benefits of his representation, but only then did they seek to say, we were unduly influenced to enter into it. But even if that were the case, that would make the fee agreement voidable and not void, and they didn't take appropriate steps to try to avoid the fee agreement. What they wanted to do was to accept all the benefits of that agreement while saying we don't have to do anything that we agreed to do under the fee agreement. And as a matter of law, you can't accept all the benefits of a contract while also seeking to avoid it. So it was appropriate for the court to say, as a matter of law, under these undisputed facts, you ratified this agreement, even if there was some evidence that you may have been unduly influenced at the time you signed it.
Mr. Sepikoff, my understanding of reading the court's order was not so much even if you were unduly influenced to enter it. It was saying the ratification was not made under undue influence.
Yeah, I know the court made that statement. I don't quite understand exactly what that phraseology meant, but this court, of course, can uphold the determination on any grounds, and clearly under the undisputed facts at the time of the motion, had been ratified by the actions of the Bernards. But also, I think it's important to point out that even if the court were to find that the fee agreement was not enforceable as a written fee agreement, under the Mullins case, if the fee agreement is not upheld, then Mr. Posner is entitled to a reasonable fee because he completed the representation and the Bernards were clearly on notice that they would be expected to pay for the services. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Going back to your earlier question, there was no time and labor analysis. There were specific examples of improper billing, and the court's ruling allows then Mr. Posner and Mr. Williams to retain fees that they earned because they did clerical work. That's improper as a matter of law. Now, there's no reference in the contingent agreement that there can be a recovery based on quantum merit. There's language in the brief and in some of the cases that talk about substantial completion of services. In a contingent fee contract, based on the definition of contingency that's in the form, a recovery, the client's obligation to pay is not triggered until there is a recovery. The obligation doesn't arise by virtue of services. The obligation to pay requires recovery. If you're going to get paid other than from recovery, you've got to provide for that in the agreement, and if you're going to do it based on quantum merit, you have to give the client notice of the quantum merit possibility. In this case, there was a presumption of undue influence. Mr. Posner is Mr. The Bernards' attorney. There's a fiduciary relationship. Under the case law, undue influence is presumed, regardless of all the other facts that I think the court can look at and should have looked at to conclude that there was undue influence, but he determined as a matter of law, based on ratification, that the contract had been ratified. But there are no findings that what the Benaris knew in terms of the nature and extent of the fees that they had been charged, or if they intended to ratify this agreement. What the evidence is the settlement had been reached in the memorandum of understanding. The Benaris were advised to some extent about some specifics regarding the billing on November 11th. Immediately, that became part of the settlement agreement, because then the settlement agreement provided that all of the attorney's fees under the contingent fee agreement were to be deposited in the registry of the court. So the Benaris did not accept all of the benefits, knowing the full facts. As soon as they had some information to believe that there were facts suggesting that this contract was a problem, they immediately objected, and the settlement agreement reflects the fact that they were objecting to the contingent arrangement.
Counsel, at the time the contingent fee agreement was entered into with Mr. Posner, the Benaris were represented by counsel, correct?
Correct.
And did counsel have an opportunity to review the prior billings?
Certainly.
Okay. And I understand there may be privilege issues, and there may be waivers, I don't know, but did counsel advise the Benaris at that time that they were operating under undue influence?
No. Well, okay, my time is up.
You can ask the question.
Okay. No, because all of the facts regarding the negotiation of the contingent fee agreement weren't known, and again, the full nature and extent of the overcharging wasn't known.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument this morning.